Well, open your Bibles, if you will, to the book of Ruth. The book of Ruth. When I first came to know the Lord, I've shared that story with you before, but I was pretty analytical about the final steps of deciding to become a Christian. And I actually made a physical list of the things that were going to change when I put my trust in Christ. These are the things that are going to have to stop. These are the things that I won't be able to do anymore. These are the friends that I will not hang out with. These are pretty analytical, kind of true to my nature. And when you looked at that sheet of paper, it looked like everything was going away. And there was no plus column, you know? What is amazing to me looking back is how small, insignificant, and stupid the ones were that were on the "you're going away" list, and all the stuff on the plus side that I really had no idea was going to be coming my way. And perhaps the one that surprised me the most and has made the greatest single impact in my life from a relational standpoint is I'll call it the gift of family. When I came to know the Lord, a month shy of my 20th birthday, I had lived an awful lot of life. I had gone to college when I was 16 in Europe. I had lived all over the world. My family structure was pretty fractured. And as a matter of fact, I've never lived near any of my family members ever since becoming an adult. And when I came to know the Lord, my social structure was my friends. And since the majority of those friends were on the gotta-go-away list, I was facing a pretty blank wall as it related to what was going to happen with all those relationships. And the truth of the matter is, you know, 30-whatever years, almost pushing 40 years ago, what God has done is given me an unbelievably high-functioning, wonderful, loving family relationships that I knew not of. I had no idea that that was going to be one of the most significant byproducts of my salvation. I knew it was right. I knew that I wanted to serve Him. I knew I needed to bow before a holy God. I knew all of that, but I had no idea that coming my way for the rest of my life was the social structure of the family of God. So much so that my dad now says, when he's laughing about me, that I have two biological brothers, but the closest brother to me is Dennis. And he's right in a certain sense. Now, over the years, my brothers and I have had a growing relationship, so much so that my one brother is making noise about moving out here and putting his kids in school. And my goodness, would that be a change for me to have a family member where you could actually see them on holidays or do something with them? And so maybe God's going to give that as well. But in the meantime, what He has done over those 40 years is fill my life with extraordinarily meaningful relationships, many of whom are much stronger than relationships even with your brothers or sisters or family members. So when we get to this woman in Matthew 1 that we're going to talk about today, Ruth, the gift she's going to give us is the understanding of just that, the gift of family. And so let's go through it and see if we can't see that by the time we come out. If you're in Ruth, the book of Ruth, you want to start there in Ruth chapter 1, verse number 1, and look at and see where this woman comes from. Let's do a little checking to see where this book fits in the history or the unfolding of the Old Testament. It says in Ruth chapter 1, verse 1, "Now it came about in the days when the judges governed that there was a famine in the land." Now, the days that the judges governed. If you turn to Judges chapter 2, verses 16 and following, the Bible says this: "Then the Lord raised up judges who delivered them from the hands of those who plundered them. And yet they did not listen to their judges, for they played the harlot after other gods and bowed themselves down to them. They turned aside quickly from the way in which their fathers had walked in obeying the commandments of the Lord. They did not do as their fathers. And when the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge and delivered them from the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. For the Lord was moved to pity by their groaning because of those who oppressed and afflicted them." The book of Ruth is in a context. It's in the historical context of the period of the judges. I put in your notes there just a little outline of how the Old Testament unfolds in terms of a structure. The first five books are the books of the law, or we call it the Pentateuch. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Those five are what we would call the law. Then the next books are history books, and there are 12 of them then. Then there are five poetry books. Poetry not meaning it rhymes, but poetry meaning it's a genre of literature. And so there are five books there: Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon. In my own devotional life, I'm right in the middle of the poetry books right now. And then there are five what we call major prophets. The word major just meaning longer, not more important, not more significant, not saying more, you know, zippy stuff, but just the longest of the prophecies. And then 12 minor prophets. Again, minor not meaning less important, but just shorter. So the Old Testament divides up with 5 law, 12 history, 5 poetry, 5 major prophets, and 12 minor prophets. Now, another way to look at this, well, first off, you'll see that Ruth sits right in the middle of the history books, right behind the book of Judges. And in a historical sense, it actually fits in the beginning part of the book of Judges. On the second page of your notes, I stole a chart out of one of my old Bibles, and it'll help you see historically where this story fits. And again, the dates are very flexible. They're what they call usher dates, a scholar of time gone by. I'm not holding to these dates, but what I want you to see is how it unfolds. There's the period of beginnings, which would include the fall and the flood and all those things. Then there's what we call the patriarchal period, the big dudes that we know a lot about. Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and the unfolding of God choosing a people for himself. Then we get to the third period, which really has to do with the time of their being in Egypt up to the time they actually get into the promised land. And that's going to cover Moses or Joseph first, and then Moses, the Exodus itself. They're passing into the River Jordan. We talked a little bit about Rahab last week. That would come right there after they crossed the River Jordan. First place they hit was the city of Jericho. So Rahab would fit right in there. And then the next period is what we call the period of the judges. Most of you already know this, but let me remind you that when they moved into the land, they conquered it. They had really three sets of battles to the east, to the north, and to the south. To the west, the north, and the south. Three campaigns. And when they finished those campaigns, they didn't utterly conquer everyone in the promised land. In fact, it kind of fragmented. Some areas were conquered and some areas were not. God did not give them a single ruler over all of the land. He gave them regional rulers, and those regional rulers were known as judges. They were an actual judge. If you were duking it out between yourselves, and I actually would like this job, you know, you guys are fussing, and so Judge Judy only makes Judge Sherry, and, you know, you'd come and I would figure out who, you know, who's bad, who's good. There was some of that, but more it was more of a political and to a large extent a spiritual position of ruling and reigning over an area. And we're in that historical period. Israel's fragmented, lots of little sections, lots of little judges. They overlap each other in time. And the book of Judges is the story of each of those judges and how they rule and some really cool things that happen. I will tell you that kids in 3rd, 4th, 5th grade love the book of Judges because it's a short stories about somebody pretty powerful. There's a lot of stabbing goes on. You know, there's a real cool left-handed stab, folds over fat. I mean, it's really exciting for that age group. But anyway, in the middle of the book of Judges is where our story of Ruth occurs. Now, just to finish off so you can see the way the rest of the Old Testament unfolds, then we enter into a period we call the United Kingdom. The children of Israel cry out to God and say, everybody else has a king. How come we don't have a king? We don't have a king. We don't have a king. And finally, God relents and lets them have a king. Not his first choice. And Saul would prove to not be a great king. But at that point, all those little regional judges gave their control and power over to a united kingdom. And then the United Kingdom actually had 3 kings: Saul, then David, and David's son Solomon. And then the kingdom splits. We call it the divided kingdom. There's there's nine or so tribes to the north and two or so tribes to the south. One gets amalgamated in, and it's a divided kingdom. Solomon's son Rehoboam takes the southern kingdom, and a guy by the name of Jeroboam takes the northern kingdom. And then there is a whole succession of kings. The kings in the north are mostly bad. The kings in the south are a little of this and a little of that. During the time of the divided kingdom, God sent prophets, lots of them, to try to warn the people. Clean up your act, judgment is coming. And each of the prophets on that little chart over on the right-hand side, starting with Elijah and Elisha, and then moving through prophets that actually have books in our Bible, Jonah, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, and so forth, they're listed there for you. Most of them began and did most of their work, not all of it, but most of it during the period of the divided kingdom. Then, as you understand the story, indeed, God's warning came to pass. You didn't clean up your act and judgment came. It came in the first flow by the nation of Assyria carting off the top north tribes and ruining them, if you will. And then, you know, 100 or so years later, the Babylonian kingdom comes up and they indeed have a series of battles. Jerusalem falls and the children of Israel systematically displaced. Going over to Babylon. We had all that discussion with Daniel. It's the exilic. It's the exile. And so after the exile, they're going to come back. Great books to study and read and get a sense of what happens when they came back with the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. And there are stories about what happened when they came back from exile. And then there's about 400 years of silence that our Bible doesn't tell us what was going on until the New Testament period. So all of that to say, the book of Ruth and the discussion of Our Lady falls right into the period of the judges. Now this is a history book that was highly, and is to this day, highly regarded by Jewish people. This book of Ruth is read publicly at one of their feast days, the feast day of Pentecost. Pentecost being an anniversary or a commemoration of the time when the law was given in Mount Sinai. And so every June on their liturgical calendar, the Jews will sit and listen to the reading of the book of Ruth. It is a highly exalted book, even though it's a little tiny book in our Bible, and a seemingly fairly innocuous story. So let's talk about that story. If you got your Bible open to Ruth, which I don't, give me a moment. Let's jump into the story. We're trying to figure out where's this gift of family. In verse number 1, the latter part of verse 1 says, a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the land of Moab with his wife and his two sons. And I resisted the urge to have yet another map in your notes today. So you will have to trust me and look up where Moab is. But it's on the eastern side of the River Jordan down a little bit. And they are... they have a long history of enemy status with Israel themselves. So during the time of the judges, during the time of famine, this guy, and his name is in verse 2, the name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife was Naomi, and the name of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, and they were from Bethlehem. They were Ephraimites from Bethlehem in Judah. Now they entered the land of Moab, and they remained there. So first off, we know this is not such a swell decision he's made. The Moabites and the Israelites were not to have any contact. There was to be no intermarrying. They were not to look to them for sustenance. They were not to look for them to solve their problems. Moab was an idolatrous group of people that were to be separate from Israel. When Israel got in trouble, they were supposed to turn their face towards God and not all the alliances and allegiances that they might be able to get with nations around them. But here we have an instance, a famine hits the land, and the first thing that happens is this particular family, and I would guess many others, boogied out of Israel, going to Moab, trying to get away from the time of the famine. When they get there, verse 3 tells us that the husband died, and then Naomi was left with her two sons, and so they took wives. The alarm bells should be going off in your mind. Wrong, 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 very wrong. Not only were they not supposed to be there, not only were they not to look to them for their sustenance, but certainly intermarrying. And we won't take the time to convince you of all that. There's plenty of scriptures that will talk about it. But the bottom line is they were not to intermarry. And when they got there, husband dies, the two boys intermarry. They take for themselves Moabite wives. One of the wife, number one, was named Orpha, and the wife of the other is named Ruth. And they lived there about 10 years. And verse 5 says, then the boys died off. And now the women now Naomi doesn't have her husband, nor does she have her two sons. Now, just interestingly, Elimelech's name means my God is king. He didn't act like it in his choice to move to Moab. And Naomi's name means pleasantness. And when at a certain point she gives a description of how she's feeling about herself, she goes off of this name and the meaning of the name and calls herself bitterness. You know, you may want to think of me as being pleasant, but I mean, this is not a pleasant life. This is bad. And Mahlon means sickly one, and Chilion means pining or wasting or pouting one. Really good sons there. Great stock. Orpha, the Moabite daughter-in-law, her name means stubbornness, and in fact, she's going to end up staying in Moab. And Ruth, her name means literally one of two things, either something worth seeing, a high and exalted name, or a female friend, also a key indicator of what's in this book. So in the form of death, judgment hits this family. So in verse 6, Naomi's rising up with her daughter-in-laws, and she says, hey, I'm returning. There's no reason for me to stay in Moab anymore. My husband's gone. My two boys are gone. And I've heard that the land of Moab, that the Lord visited his people in giving food, but I'm going home. So she departed from the place where she was, and her two daughter-in-laws with her, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. And in verse 8, she stops and she turns to the two daughters-in-law and says, hey, go, return each of you to your mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with me as you've dealt kindly with the dead, my two boys, and with me. May the Lord grant you that you'd find rest, each in the house of a husband. Go back to the Moabite place, find your husband, and, you know, peace on you. You've been good daughter-in-laws, but we're done. And then she kisses them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And you would expect that. Daughters-in-law live there. I don't know when they got married, but years. They have a relationship. It's a sad thing. But Naomi says, I'm going home. You guys need to stay here and get your husbands. Verse 10, they said to her, no, but we will surely return with you. Naomi says in verse 11, return, my daughters. Why should you go with me? I don't have any more sons in my womb. There's no more husbands coming. You return, you go. I'm too old to have a husband. If I said I had had hope, if I should even have a husband tonight and bear sons, you can't wait around until they're grown up. So, you know, you're going to refrain from marrying? Of course not. My daughters, for it's harder for me than for you. The hand of the Lord has gone forth against me. The judgment that she feels about their decision to go and then to have their sons intermarry is heavy on her. She wants to go back. Verse 14, they lifted up their voices, they wept. Orpha, you know, caves in, kisses her mother-in-law, and heads home. But Ruth clung to her. Verse 15, then she said, behold, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and her gods. Key phrase here. She's gone back to the people, and she's going back to the old ways. She's going to that foreign worship. She's going to do what we've been doing for years, and it wasn't right. I'm going home, I'm going to Israel, I'm going to make it right, I'm going to get Yahweh back on the throne of my heart. But she's going back, hey, you should go. And then Ruth said to her in verse 16, do not urge me to leave you or to turn back from following you, for where you go, I will go, where you lodge, I will lodge. And here comes the important part, your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Now, lots of you have that in the inside of your wedding bands, and it's one of the famous phrases that's used, you know, in reference to a marriage relationship, but this has nothing to do with marriage. This is a young woman to an older woman. This is a daughter-in-law to her mother-in-law. She is saying, in essence, no, I'm making a calculated, thoughtful decision. I'm not going back to the old way. I'm not going back to my ancestral people. I'm going to Israel with you, and your God is going to be my God. I am abandoning this and facing you and everything you stand for. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Thus may the Lord do to me, and worse, if anything but death parts you and me. When she saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. Now, just a moment or two. Ruth is expressing to her mother-in-law, Naomi, a unparalleled sense of commitment and devotion. This is beyond any family responsibilities. She is freed from all of her family responsibilities when her husband died. She has no responsibility to Naomi. She has nothing that she should tradition fulfill. There is no tie to her at all. There's no reason, which is why Orpha bails. You know, Orpha realizes, no, I need a husband, and I'm going to have to go, you know, back home and get my husband, and back to life as usual, and thanks, it's been good, and I love you, and I care about you, but, you know, right when you get work, and I'm going home. And Ruth, on the other hand, phrases her devotion to her mother-in-law in such an unbelievable way, and identifying herself not just with Ruth, but with everything that, not just with Naomi, but with everything that Naomi holds dear, and particularly her relationship and her worship of Yahweh. And so then the story goes on, and what happens is they get back in verse 19. They both went until they came to Bethlehem. When they get there, the city was all stirred up because of them. I mean, wow, look who's here. And the woman, then this is where she says, don't call me Naomi, don't call me pleasant, call me Mara, which means bitterness. For the Lord has dealt very bitterly with me. I did wrong. My husband and I made wrong decisions. I am suffering under the penalty of disobedience. And so I'm not coming home any kind of a conquering hero or anything else. I'm coming home broken because I was wrong. Verse 20 or verse 21, I went out full, the Lord's brought me back empty. And you see, since the Lord has witnessed against me and the Almighty has afflicted me. She's got it all straight in her heart. She understands, I did wrong, God has held me accountable, my disobedience has created something that's heartbreaking, I'm returning, but I'm not coming back joyfully. So verse 22 simply says that she returned. And they came into Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. Now, of course, this is an agrarian society, and the harvest of each crop would be a big, major deal. And what you need to know by way of background is the way they handled the poor among them is when they harvested their fields, they didn't harvest the edges. So they, you know, plow down the middle. They didn't have a plow, but they'd go down the middle and harvest everything in the center section of their field. But the edges, they just left it there on the field. And it was a very understood thing that those that were poor and didn't have fields of their own would come and glean along the edges of any field. Every family did it. The more generous left wider margins, you know, larger numbers of rows along the edges. And so when they get there, it's the time of the barley feast. Naomi had a kinsman, a distant relative of her husband, a man of great wealth of the same family of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. Boaz owns a lot of land. Ruth says to Naomi, please, Ruth says to Naomi, let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after one in whose sight I may find favor. And Naomi, the mother-in-law, says, okay, you can go. And so she departs, and she does just that. She gleans in the field along those edges, getting a portion that belonged to Boaz. In verse 4, when Boaz came in from the town, he said to the reapers, may the Lord be with you. They said to him, may the Lord bless you. Verse 5, Boaz says to his servant who was in charge of the reapers, hey, who's that girl over there? And the servant in charge of the reapers answered and said, well, she's the young Moabite woman who came home with Naomi from Moab. And she said, please let me glean and gather after the reapers. And thus she comes, and she's remained from morning until now. She's sitting in the house for a little break. So Boaz says to Ruth, listen carefully, my daughter. Do not go and glean in any other field. You don't have to go next door tomorrow and do the edges in his field. I want you to just stay here. Stay with my maids. Let your eyes be on the field which they reap and go after them. Indeed, I've commanded the servants not to touch you. When you're thirsty, you go to the water jars that, you know, we have, and you drink. And so her response is overwhelming gratitude. Verse 10, she falls on her face, bows to the ground and says, well, why have I found such favor that you should take notice of me? Hint, hint, I'm a foreigner. I'm not one of yours. I have no connections here. Boaz, verse 11 says, well, all that you've done for your mother-in-law after the death of her husband has been fully reported to me. The family all knows. And how you left your father and your mother in the land of your birth, and you came to a people you did not previously know. Pause. She came empty. She's got no relationships other than her mother-in-law. This decision is a decision to abandon everything. In that culture, if something happened to your husband, you went home. You went home to dad. And you stayed in his house until you remarried. When something bad would happen, the couples would come together. A son would go home to his parents' house and they would live all together until such a time he could make another home for him and his wife. It was the natural course of things to find a solace in your family relationships. In a normal course of action, she would have gone home. She did it. She went with Naomi. Verse 14, at mealtime, he says to her, come over here, eat some of the bread, dip your piece of bread in the vinegar. She sat beside the reapers. He served her roasted grain. She ate and was satisfied, and then she left. When she rose up to glean, Boaz commanded his servant, saying, hey, let her have a go. Don't just make her do the edges. Don't insult her. Don't make her feel funny. Verse 16, and also you shall purposely pull out for her some grain, not only leaving the edges, but when you're going through, dump a little on the ground. So when she comes behind you, there's plenty. Verse 17, she gleans in the field to evening. She beat out what she had. You know, barley was some sort of stalk thing. You'd whack it so that the kernels would fall out. She does that. And she had a certain amount, an ephah of barley. And then she takes it, went into the city, goes to her mother-in-law and shows her what she's got. And boy, Naomi's happy. Her mother-in-law in verse 19 said, well, where did you glean today? And where did you work? May he who took notice of you be blessed. So she told her mother-in-law about everything that happened. The man that I met today and I worked with him, his name was Boaz. And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, well, may he be blessed. He has not withdrawn his kindness to the living and to the dead. Naomi said to her, well, the man is our relative. He's one of our closest relatives. He's a kinsman. Then Ruth the Moabite said, furthermore, he said to me, hey, come back tomorrow, stay close. There'll be plenty for you. And verse 22, Naomi says, that's a good deal, daughter, that you go out with the maids. You go and do it. And so verse 23, she stayed close by the maids in order to glean until the end of the barley harvest and the wheat harvest. And she lived with her mother-in-law. So this is good. They're getting their sustenance taken care of because Boaz is allowing her to glean behind his men. Chapter 3 then, Naomi, your mother-in-law, says, my daughter, shall I not seek security for you that it may be well with you? You need to be married. Remember, we've talked about this before. Being unmarried was the worst possible thing that could happen to a woman. She's got to have a husband. And in order to have a husband, or when she has a husband, then there's the potential of the heirs of the family line coming through. No husband, no grandsons. So she's saying, boy, we got to get you married off. And verse 2, and now is not Boaz your kinsman with whose maid you were? Behold, he winnows barley at the threshing floor tonight. So here's the plan. Sweetie, I want you to wash yourself, anoint yourself, put on your best clothes, and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he's finished eating and drinking. And it shall be when he lies down that you shall notice the place where he lies, and you'll go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what you should do. And she said to him, all that you tell me to do, I will do. This sounds like a weird set of circumstances. Go to the threshing floor, hang around till after everybody's eaten and drinking. When everybody lays down to go to sleep, go over near him, pull the cloth back off his toes, and then he's going to pay attention to you. That's a good thing. We want him to pay attention to you. It's a cultural deal. It's nothing sexual. It's not anything that's inappropriate. It just has to do with the process that would have taken place in a threshing floor. Now, what Naomi's getting at, though, here is a principle called the role of the kinsman redeemer. Kinsman redeemer. In Deuteronomy chapter 25 and verse 5, we talked about this a few weeks ago, by instruction, at the death of a brother, the other brother was required, as the redeemer of the family, to take the wife of the dead brother and make her his wife as well, for the purpose of several things. One, that the land would remain within the family, and two, that there could be sons, and the name of the father, who is dead, could be perpetrated through the line of the sons and grandsons and so forth. So the job of the kinsman redeemer is a very locked-in principle in Old Testament thinking. And And here, Naomi's mind is cranking. Got to get her married. Where are we going to get her married? My husband didn't have any brothers, so that isn't going to work. Is there any cousins? What about uncles? What about, you know, nephews? So she's cranking on that regard. So she's asking Ruth to make sure that Boaz notices her. And in fact, the balance of chapter 3 is precisely that. She does do that. She lay in verse 14 at his feet until morning. And when she's finished, he gives her, you know, a whole bunch more barley. And she comes home. Mom-in-law in verse 16 says, well, how did it go? She told her what had happened. She said, wow, 6 measures of barley you gave to me. He didn't want me to come home empty-handed. And so she says in verse 18, wait, my daughter, until you know the matter turns out, for the man will not rest until he's settled it today. So she says, okay, we've let it be known that you're available. We have indicated that we understand the principle of the kinsman redeemer. And so now let's see what he does. Chapter 4, Boaz goes up to the city gate. And why does he go to the gate? Because that's where they did business. That was the city hall. If you wanted to do any kind of serious business, you went to the city gate. You sat down. The elders of the town would have been there. The guys that are going to make decisions would have been there. So Boaz goes and he sits down and the close relative of whom Boaz spoke was passing by. Boaz knows that there's somebody that is a closer relative than himself to the line of Elimelech. And so he says, turn aside, friend, and sit down. He turned aside, sit down. Now, the 10 men of the elders of the city said, sit here. So they sit down. They're now ready to do business. So the guy that was the closest relative, Naomi, who has come back from the land of Moab, has to sell the piece of land which belonged to her brother. So I bought it to inform you, saying, here it is. Here's the land. She wants to sell it. It's your right to buy it. And in the latter part of chapter, or verse 4, he says, great, I'll buy it. I'll redeem it. I get more land. Then Boaz in verse 5 says, well, on the day you buy the land, you also get Ruth, the widow of the deceased, in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance. He's just reminding him of the full measure of the role of a redeemer kinsman, someone who is a close relative that has a right to it, but who is wanting to do the redeeming, the buying back. That's what redemption means. He wants the land, but in verse 6, the closest relative says, well, I can't redeem it for myself, lest I jeopardize my own inheritance. Redeem it yourself, and you may have my right of redemption, for I can't make the deal. Verse 7, now this was the custom in former lands or times in Israel concerning the redemption and the exchange of land. So, okay, that's been resolved. Verse 8, so the closest relative affirms it again. You buy it for yourself. And he took off his shoe. When they took off their shoe, that was the deal was settled. In our culture, you sign on the bottom line. In their culture, you took your shoe off and handed them your sandal. So he hands him his sandal and said, great, you can have it, you buy it, whatever. Verse 9, so then Boaz says to the elders and all the people, your witnesses, here it is, I bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon. Moreover, I have acquired Ruth, the widow of Mahlon, to be my wife in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance, so that the name of his deceased may be cut off from, may not be cut off, rather, from his brothers or from the court of his birthplace. And all the people were in the court. The elders said, yep, we're witnesses. This is a good deal. We understand what you're doing. So verse 13, Boaz takes Ruth and she became his wife. He went into her and the Lord enabled her to conceive and she gave birth to a son. Now let's just pause a second. The role of the redeemer kinsman is a big deal in the Old Testament. And it's a big deal because it foreshadows a very big deal in the New Testament. The role of the Redeemer is clearly outlined. It's very, very clear in the Old Testament legally that Redeemer had to be someone that was a very near kinsman. He must perform. He has to be willing to do the work of the redemption. He has to be able to do the work of the redemption. He's got to have the money. He's got to have the goods. He's got to have the resources. He's got to be free himself to do it. And he must have the actual price of redemption. He's got to be able to produce in order to make certain that his role as the Goel, as it's called, the redeemer kinsman in the Old Testament. But what's so powerful here is that the redeemer kinsman in the Old Testament is a picture of who? Of Christ, who had to be a near kinsman. He had to be one of us. He had to be a man and fully God. He had to be willing. I'm willing. He says it the night before he died. I'd prefer the cup to pass me by, but I am willing. He had to be able to do it, and uniquely only Christ was able to pay the price. He has to be free to do it, and he certainly exercised that. And then there had to be the price of redemption, and the price of redemption was the shedding of his blood. So we are seeing pictured in Ruth and Boaz the work of the Redeemer kinsman. Absolutely a powerful, powerful picture of Boaz as a type of Christ. But I don't want you to miss something. In the latter part of chapter 4, verse 14, the women said to Naomi, this is after Ruth has now had this son, "Blessed is the Lord who has not left you without a redeemer today, and may his name become famous in Israel. May he also be to you a restorer of life and a sustainer of your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and is better to you than seven sons, has given you a grandson." Now, who is this son? Just any old kid? Any old person in Israel? No. Naomi took the child and laid her in her lap and became his nurse. And the neighbor woman gave him a name, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi." To Naomi. Not to Naomi, to Ruth. But to Naomi in a sense, in that her family line is going to continue. So they named him Obed. Okay, good. Anybody know anything about Obed? No. Well, he's the father-in-law of Jesse. Anybody know anybody named Jesse? And still not much. How about this next one? The father of David. Obed, the son that's laying in Naomi's lap, the grandson, the son of Ruth and Boaz, is the grandfather of David. Do you think that's a significant piece to the genealogical line from which all of the Old Testament speaks of Christ being of the line of David? It is a really, really big deal. When Naomi gets that baby in her lap, everything that she reflected on and when she called herself Mara is gone. The bitterness is gone. God has replaced that with something so significant. She thought her husband died, her two sons died. She told her two daughter-in-laws to stay where they were. She was going home a bitter, lonely, single, cranky old lady who had no hope for the rest of her life to have any kind of earthly relationships. It was over. But instead, God brings in the Redeemer kinsman, he buys the land, he marries the girl, they have a son, and from that son, the grandfather now is the grandfather of David. So there is a remarkable gift that Ruth gives us. And remember, the context for this study is four women in the book of Matthew unusually mentioned for us. And why would Ruth, a woman who had done real wrong, real bad stuff, now be in the lineage of Christ himself? Because she's the grandma. She's the one that God has blessed by having a daughter-in-law, and then the daughter-in-law marrying Boaz, and now here's the son. The gift for you and I is that when our lives are focused on Christ, we get given an extended family. We get given an unbelievable sense of belonging. I can tell you personally that having never lived in my family, and to a great extent having fractured relationships, what I got when I was, 20 years old was an amazing gift. And here, almost 40 years later, everyone who is near and dear to my life, with the exception of some of my relationships now with my family members, but much more beyond that, are all people that God gave me because I became a believer. They're brothers and sisters in Christ. The little church that I went to when I first got saved, I was this 20-year-old, definitely rough around the edges. And all of the sweet ladies of that church just kind of came around me and kind of enveloped me like a marshmallow. And just kind of, this one needs some help, let's help her. And over the 15 years that I was in that church, my relationship with some of those women is dear, very dear. Mrs. Bell is one I think of. Her husband just recently died. And I was one of the few. She had five or six people that she let in the room when her husband was near to death. And three of them were her own children. And I was number four. That is a relationship that has been given to me. I wasn't born into the Bell family. What we have here is a gift that's not a biological family. It's an extended spiritual family. and over again, God has done that in my life. And my contention today is that as you serve him, he will do the same for you. He will give you brothers and sisters. He will give you spiritual children. He will give you spiritual parents. He will give you spiritual aunts and uncles. And ultimately, if we live long enough, spiritual grandkids. I got a note the other day. One of the kids that's in the first class that graduated from Stony Brook has just got engaged. And I was a little worried about this one. I wasn't sure he was going to make it. Some social things. Oh, I don't know. He hadn't gotten married yet. He hadn't really done what I was going to do. And here came this gorgeous picture of him and this gal and asking me to save the date because they really want me to be there. And I wouldn't miss it for the world. That, you know, he's a spiritual kid. Lord willing, there'll be some spiritual grandkids. We've got, you know, relationships with the gal whose parents were killed in the car accident. And every time she takes a new picture of her baby that never should have been born, much less be healthy, I receive it like a spiritual grandma. Woo, look at this. Woo, Michaela's doing really good. Ah, can you believe that? These are precious relationships. And what we need to do is, as I said in your notes, extend some loyalty to those relationships that God has put in our lives. The obvious one is to your mate, your spouse. I'm not even going to get into that. But the truth of the matter is that's where a lot of time and attention should be going in our spiritual lives is to our mates. And then, you know, extended families, you know, mothers-in-law, fathers-in-law, and so forth. Then to friendships, great friendships that will mean the world to you. All you got to do is have a major life event, something where you're knocked off course. Health is the one that comes to mind immediately, but a serious health issue. And watch who comes to meet that need. Watch what they do, what they say, where they are, and how they present themselves. That's not going to be, for me, my biological family, for the most part, although they have been lovely. But for a larger, extended, family, it's my spiritual family. If something bad happens to me at 2 in the morning and I've got 3 phone calls, likely it might not be to a biological family. Those 3 phone calls might be to people that God has given to my life. And they deserve some loyalty from me. And I threw in loyalty to our country, too, just because this is a time in our country's history where it's very... It's very natural and normal and almost expected to criticize everything that happens around us and all of our leaders. And the truth of the matter is, Jesus himself put a stamp of approval on earthly government when he did the business about the coin for taxes in Matthew 17. So while we live in a land that allows us the freedom to criticize, there is also a requirement, to a certain extent, of loyalty to those leaders. The truth of the matter is that Ruth teaches us that God gives us people. Psalm 125, the Lord is around about his people. And then in the latter part of that psalm, peace be in Israel. Peace meaning relax. We're secure. There's people around us. If you're in one of those life situations where the bottom is falling out and you need support, I want to encourage you to know that the body of Christ will be there for you. And it will be there in proportion to you being there for others. If you're isolated and have no contact, you know, your sister is the only one you ever talk to. This family is the only one you ever go to dinner with. This, you know, extended relationships don't happen. Well, when the tide turns and you're the one standing out on the rock needing someone to come by in a boat and pick you up, you know, you better hope that those 2 or 3 that you invested in are available and that their boat doesn't have a hole in it. But if, on the other hand, you're extending your love, your devotion, your care to an extended spiritual family, you find yourself on the rock, well, just sit back and relax because boat after boat after boat is going to go by with an attempt to rescue you. And which would you rather have? A very isolated little sphere of family relationships or an extended family? I'd rather have the extended family. So... Psalm 133 says how good and how pleasant it is when brothers dwell in unity. And God does not intend for individuals to live in isolation, but that we live in a community. Some of us are better at that than others. I'm not so good at that. I'm not. I have to work at it. The phone rings at night. I don't want to answer it. I don't. why are you calling? It's nighttime. You should not be calling. And my definition of nighttime is anything after 5 o'clock. I go home, I put alligators in the moat, and I bring the drawbridge up. You know, well, someone's knocking on my door. Why? That is my first response. It is. I'm not saying it's good. I'm just saying that is my first emotional response. But because I've been on the receiving end of all of that love and devotion from other people, I am learning to not act that way. I'm actually sounding semi-pleasant when I answer the phone. And I now have a friend, a particular friend, who I've given her such liberty, she comes by the house and just shows up. And the other night she showed up at dinner time. And we just divided the dinner in three ways, and had a lovely meal together. I'm learning. But I'm learning because it's been so awash on me for such a long time. It's worth it to me to want to be receptive and to develop that part of my heart. And I'm saying to you that God intends that to happen. We're part of a family. A family I put down is not a composite of perfect people. Even in your biological family, you've got weirdos in there. I know you do. You got the strange ones, the one that doesn't work very good. The family gets together and we got to work around Susie or Uncle somebody or whatever. But for us as a spiritual group, it's the same way. We're not all peaches and cream either, but we are a family. Second thing is, a family is a series of relationships and responsibilities. Brianna had a situation where her usual ride back to school didn't happen, and so kind of out of the blue, Sunday afternoon when I was absolutely buried with everything and Barb was really sick, she says, "Can I have a ride back to school?" Now that's an hour up and an hour back if there's no traffic. Sunday afternoon. I'm thinking, nap, work, get Bible study done, drive 2.5 hours. I didn't look at her and say, "No, I'm sorry, honey, I can't. You don't do that. She's your kid. She needs a ride. You go." It's under the category of responsibilities. It's that same way in the spiritual body. There are times when someone's going to have a need in your spiritual family, and it isn't going to be convenient. She needs a meal now. I can barely get tuna fish on the table for my own family. She needs a meal. Yeah, she needs a meal. Give her tuna fish too, who cares? It's a series of relationships and a series of responsibilities. Third thing I put down is that a family is united in spite of circumstances and convenience. In spite of that, they're for each other. And lastly, of course, a family is forever. We're going to spend all eternity together. We might want to warm up to the idea that we're going to be near each other. That we're going to interact forever. We're going to work together forever. We're going to live close. We're going to fellowship. The normal focuses of regular life are going to happen, and they're going to happen with our spiritual brothers and sisters. It might be a good idea to start warming up to that idea. So the gift that Ruth is bringing to you and me is the gift of the sense of family. And I'm encouraging you to look around within your church body, within your small groups, within people in our Bible study, and remember how important that gift of family is. It means everything to me. Ask yourself this question: who's going to show up at your funeral? Who's going to show up at your funeral? One writer said, "I just hope I have 6 friends who are strong enough to carry the box." But the truth of the matter is, we all want more than that. Don't you want a memorial service where your name and your history is rehearsed in a positive fashion? You don't want just your mother-in-law and your father-in-law who have to be here, and, you know, 2 brothers and a sister and 3 kids who, you know, must. You want there to be a reflection of your life in the family members that you've invested in. So I encourage you to do it. Let's pray. Lord, thanks for the reminder in the life of Ruth of the gift of family that comes when we put our faith and trust in you. We get the amazing gift of extended family members who love us and care for us, who are true friends to rebuke us when we need it, to encourage us when we need it, to seek from us gifts that we have that might be of benefit or help to them. I am so grateful, Lord, for the extended family you've put into my life, and I pray that we will see that today in the life of Ruth, and I pray this in Christ's name. Amen. Well, thanks for coming. It would have been more fun without you. I actually put some discussion